Autoguard detail report to starboard hangar bay.
Welcome to Pulse Rifles and Plasma Grenades.
Would you like to know more?
You know I have a shoulder on you, you know? And it must pop, pop, pop!
I say we take off and nuke the entire site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
All right, welcome back to Pulse Rifles and Plasma Grenades. I do apologize for the long, long delay. We had a number of issues, Halloween, and I personally had to run out to California. Tonight we've got a Papa Bear couldn't make it, so we have Eric and Jay, and we are going to head and focus tonight on the Mandalorians of Star Wars, the Spartan culture that they are. Actually, before we get started, we'll go ahead and give a little bit of homage to Stan Lee.
Excelsior!
One of the very few army playwrights that ever existed. He served during World War II, and he just recently passed at 95. Anybody want to share any thoughts on Stan Lee?
Yeah, this is Jay. I'll just say, you know, I think that his passing hit me harder than I expected that it would. I mean, the guy was 95 years old, so, you know, it wasn't entirely unexpected, especially considering his wife, you know, passed in 2017. But it hit me pretty hard, you know. Stan created an entire universe, and he didn't just create it and cash in on it and move on. He lived it, and he shared those stories, and he cared about what those stories meant and the messages that they sent to people. He meant a lot to a lot of people, and you know, I think the world is worse off without him in it, but definitely better off having him here as long as he was. So definitely gonna be missed. I was happy enough, fortunate enough to meet him 2 years ago, year and a half ago at Awesome Con in DC. I'm proud to say I actually was able to make him laugh. You know, he was sitting there signing autograph after autograph after autograph, and I walked up and I handed him a copy of his autobiography, which is written in comic book form, which is really cool. And I said, make sure you don't sign on that beautiful face. And he stopped and looked up at me, started laughing, and said, thank you. So that's my one time meeting Stan the Man.
He always seemed like a very, I watched a couple interviews recently, and he just seemed like a very enthusiastic guy who really loved his job.
Yeah, good dude.
I just want to, you know, second kind of what Jay already said. I mean, he's definitely going to be sorely missed. The fact that he was such a forerunner and in his genre of writing and so forth, it's very telling. When he started, you know, certain streams of comics such as like Black Panther or the X-Men and things like that, in the height of the civil rights and you know, addressing those, you know, difficult topics in the form that he did. I mean, very, very socially conscious, and a lot of people don't realize, you know, some of the meanings behind some of the comics that he wrote. Was very, very touching on the size of the time that he was writing in.
Yeah, they hid the identity of Black Panther for the first couple of episodes to keep it at the publisher back when he didn't control Marvel. Him and the other guy that created Black Panther, like, kept the mask on him for the first couple episodes, and by the time they unveiled that it was a black character, like, they when they took the mask off, it was too late, and they couldn't get the comic pulled because it was popular, so they kind of snuck that one in under the radar.
Popularity already, you know, skyrocketed.
This is a very good man, and he was all, you know, like I said, he served World War II. He was one of, I think, only 7 army playwrights in existence. Did a lot of PAO type stuff. So here's to Stan.
Yeah? What?
For Mandalore!
Oh, this is gonna be fun. This is what I live for.
All right, so for tonight, we're gonna get on to a topic that is focused on a particular class of warrior from the Star Wars universe, the Mandalorians. Most people are familiar with, I think, just Boba Fett and Jango Fett from the original trilogy and the prequels. And we'll get into some interesting things about them and how they aren't actually Mandalorians, according to the new lore. And apparently that was George's intent all along, according to Pablo Hidalgo. But in the old legacy, they were the legends, so to speak. Now they were Mandalore. I guess Boba Fett became Mandalore at one point. But we'll try and stick mostly to the new canon. Mandalorians have been covered heavily in Clone Wars and Rebels, with new Mandalorian characters One of my favorite characters from the Coder series was Candrus Ordo, who became a Mandalore. Although I guess that's may or may not be canon anymore.
Prejudice set to maximum.
So the Mandalorians obviously were very much designed around the Spartans of old. They even have like a Spartan faceplate.
This is Sparta!
In some of the old legends, and even Boba Fett's helmet has that T-shaped Spartan divide in it. You can obviously tell that there were, you know, elements of that brought forward and modernized for the Boba Fett character, who was first introduced in 1978 in the Star Wars Holiday Special. Probably the only redeeming thing out of that kluge of laughter at this point. Maybe him and Adema, the bartender.
The only redeeming fact that came out of that.
What, you didn't like B. Arthur singing bartender?
Oh, I was going to say B. Arthur, man.
B. Arthur was definitely a kick there. So just in the general, gentlemen, if you want to touch off of historical elements that you feel fed the image of the Mandalorian, and then we'll go into the culture themselves. Any other historical analogies or traits you want to pull in?
Well, fun fact before you go into that, you know the original design for Boba Fett, he was all white, similar to the Stormtroopers?
Yeah, actually, that wasn't just a prototype character? That was the actual original design that they were going for?
That was the original design they were going with. And then I think, I can't remember who made the call, but somebody wanted Boba Fett to stand out more. Because they went down the whole bounty hunter thing instead of being an actual elite stormtrooper, kind of like, was it Phasma type thing?
Interesting. So he was a proto-Phasma.
I think they made the right call, making him a bounty hunter as opposed to an elite stormtrooper. Definitely cooler.
Interesting. Any other historical influences you think went into the design there?
Definitely think you already hit the Spartan theme. The culture as a whole, once they get, particularly in Legends, it's still covered in the new canon, but particularly in Legends, it was a very warrior-centric culture. Not only did they, now it's more of a race, the Mandalorians, but previously, any race could become a Mandalorian if they're willing to adopt the lifestyle.
Or if they were conquered and brought in, if I remember correctly.
True.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, I know in Coder, so I think some of the elements, I think we will probably see some of the Knights of the Old Republic story pieces brought forward because it was so long ago. I think the guys that did Game of Thrones, Benioff and Weiss, they're going to be doing a new series. And I think that they're going to delve back into that Old Republic period or older. There's two schools of thought with where they're going to go with that series. One is they're going to do an Old Republic series. The other is that they're going to go even further back and do like 40, like when the Jedi first came about. But I really am hoping that they do the...
If we flip back to the history, I think everybody draws that parallel to the Spartans because, you know, ancient Sparta is kind of you know, in the modern discourse, you know, ever since 300 came out. You know, you got Assassin's Creed Odyssey right now. So a lot of that Spartan culture is something that everybody's familiar with. But I think a lot of, if you look at Mandalorian culture and the way that their society is structured and all that, it really throws back a lot to kind of medieval Japan, the way that they had houses and clans that were very structured around family, their personal code of honor, settling things by one-on-one combat, that sort of thing. That's all right out of ancient Japan.
Good point. So I could see the blending there, especially when they got into the Clone Wars. They did a lot of the art styles. I could see would definitely be a blending of that mentality. So in the new canon, I think we can only really look in the new canon from, I think, Clone Wars heavily developed the Mandalorians, and then they were further refined in Rebels. In the Clone Wars, they mentioned a lot of the old stuff, which is why I think they're going to bring a lot of that Knights of the Old Republic stuff forward. In the Clone Wars, they briefly addressed the old Mando Wars with the Jedi and how the Mandalorians were constantly fighting the Jedi, and they had one Jedi from the ranks of the Mandalorians, and you get the Darksaber.
This was one of a kind. Legend tells that it was created over 1,000 years ago by Tar Vizsla, the first Mandalorian ever inducted into the Jedi Order. After his passing, the Jedi kept the saber in their temple. That was until members of House Vizsla snuck in and liberated it.
You know the story you're talking about? I think it was, I can't remember which season of Clone Wars, not Clone Wars, of Rebels that they brought it up, where they start talking about the dark saber and the one Mandalorian who became a Jedi.
I want to say
the dark saber.
I want to say it was season 3 because Sabine Wren got a hold of the dark saber in either late season 2 or early season 3 in Rebels, and she used it. It was a symbol. It had become a symbol that was passed down from house to house, and it ended up in the hands of Pre Vizsla, who was interestingly enough, was it Pre Vizsla who was voiced by Jon Favreau or was it the senator?
I do not understand why the arrival of this Jedi doesn't upset you. You promised to support the Death Watch forces so we could overthrow the Duchess Satine and her weak, peace-loving government.
We'll talk about Jon Favreau and his role in The Mandalorian, the new show, later in the episode, but his first envoy into the Star Wars universe was as one of the Clone Wars characters who was a Mandalorian.
So it is Tara Vizsla, human male. And it says here, I think this is a quote from Kanan Jarrus when they were talking about, I didn't know Mandalorians developed that type of lightsaber. Goes on, we didn't. This was one of a kind. Legend tells that it was created over 1,000 years ago by Tara Vizsla, the first Mandalorian ever inducted into the Jedi Order.
Yeah, so the Mandalorians in their entire history only have one Jedi. I would love to see a story about him because he would be that blending of the two large warrior castes we see in Star Wars of the basically the House of Jedi and the House of Mandalore. Very interesting story, I think, to see that backdrop there about how he integrated into Jedi. He took the Mandalorian ideals and blended them. The Mandalorian warrior trial by combat ethos and blended them with the Jedi peaceful way, which they always said they were a peaceful way, but you always saw them go into combat at the ready.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because the Jedi aren't warriors per se. As previously mentioned in the the first one, the Clone Wars, Phantom Menace, they're peacekeepers. They're always meant to be peacekeepers. Now there are references to the Mandalorian Jedi War, and it also referenced to the Crusaders, which goes back to Revan. So that hopefully they kind of bring him in the picture, and we see some of that, like you said, the Mandalorian Jedi conflict that goes on. But I liken the Mandalorians to like the samurai mentality and warrior ethos, whereas the Jedi are more of the monk culture. They're trained, they're defenders, whatever, but they have more of a peaceful take on life and how they conduct and handle themselves. It was when the Jedi started moving away from their center and their balance in the Force that they were pulled into conflicts. Remember Revan, when he took those Jedi and he started fighting the Mandalorian War, he went against the Jedi Council. So the Jedi were never truly warriors.
That's a good point. In that whole Coder time period, there was a schism in the Jedi for the ones that wanted to fight and the ones that didn't, because the old master just wanted to sit on their thumb and wait it out while the Sith ravaged the galaxy and the Mandalorians ravaged the galaxy. Well, I guess it was the Mandalorians first, because it was the Mandalorian War that then led into the Sith movement.
Yeah, that's true. I think at some point the Sith actually were backing Mandalorians and their conquests as they move forward throughout the known galaxy from the unknown regions.
So, then bringing it forward to the Clone Wars era, during the Clone Wars era, they definitely defined the Mandalorian a bigger play in Clone Wars because I think Dave Filoni had a real affection for them. And they lined out what I guess George had originally envisioned for the Mandalorians, vice what they'd become in a lot of the Legends novels leading up to it, where they even mentioned in one of the episodes, and we'll talk about how they weren't, I guess this would be a good lead-in, to how Jango Fett was not a Mandalorian. Governor of Mandalore was talking to Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan was like, you know, brought up Jango Fett, and the senator said, I don't know where he got that armor. He's not a Mandalorian. He's just an imposter.
Mr. Kenobi, Mandalore's violent past is behind us. All of our warriors were exiled to our moon, Concordia. They died out years ago.
Are you certain? I recently encountered a man who wore Mandalorian armor. Jango Fett.
Jango Fett was a common bounty hunter. How he acquired that armor is beyond me.
Which then leads into the fact that, you know, because Jango wasn't a Mandalorian, now Boba Fett, by inheritance, is not a Mandalorian, nor were they accepted. And that, they moved away from that old precept of anybody could be a Mandalorian to kind of a... really almost like that Aryan supremacist, everybody has to only be... only true Mandalorians were, you know, this human population that lived on Mandalore. And even amongst that, then you have Pre Vizsla, who hated outside influence even more and had a very nationalist view, so to speak, of Mandalore, where only true Mandalorians that were willing to fight, because most of Mandalore society, through the female lead there that was Obi-Wan's love interest, whose name now escapes me. Do you remember, Eric?
Satine.
Yeah, Satine. Is she an empress?
Duchess Satine
had led the Mandalorians down a peaceful path. So Death Watch and Pre Vizsla wanted to put Mandalore back on a war footing, which Satine was totally against, because she'd spent this time moving Mandalore away from the cultural stain, so to speak, that they had developed as bloodthirsty conquerors. I don't know, anybody else have a Satine Kratzi? Kratzi? I don't know how you pronounce that. I don't know, either one of you guys have any comment on the Clone Wars piece with Death Watch?
Nothing particular about Death Watch and how they came in. I think there's, you kind of covered it, where Satine was trying to take them away from the past, which I'm glad they threw that in there, because that does leave an opening for something later on where they can talk about prior to Phantom Menace, where they can talk about older stuff like the Mandalorian Wars and so forth. They can kind of bring that in, because you talk about their bloodthirsty past. But in the Clone Wars era, with Death Watch coming in and trying to kind of rekindle that type of warrior ethos, I think it you know, there were a lot of supporters, which is surprising. They talked about it. There was a lot of supporters for Death Watch that wanted to kind of rekindle that warrior ethos that they had, but they just didn't necessarily agree with their violent tactics for trying to change the regime.
And I think that you're right. It does leave open that capability for them to go back and talk about a lot of the stuff that we witnessed in the Knights of the Old Republic era, and just before that. So after we had a lot, there's a lot of Clone Wars focus on the Mandalorians, and then we move into Rebels. We kind of have almost a skip period during the originals. Okay.
So since you brought up Rebels in that little skip period, they never really finished season 6 of the Clone Wars. So when we last saw Mandalore, they were kind of being ravaged. Darth Maul had killed Satine. Death Watch was taking over, but there was no real description, or there's no canon description of how they went from a peaceful society to where they were in Rebels. Because by the time you get to Rebels, they're kind of reminiscent of what you remember before. They're broken up into clans. They have that warrior mentality. They're wearing the armor all the time. They associate themselves being a Mandalorian with their armor. So it's like, I'm not sure how they made that jump from the peaceful society back to what it was from Legends, the type of mentality for Mandalorians. That was never really explained.
It wasn't, but I think they hinted at it in ways where the lines that I would draw is Darth Maul walked in, took over Death Watch. Then what he did was turned Death Watch into almost a criminal enforcement agency for Crimson, what was Darth Maul's, the Crimson Dawn in Solo?
I believe so.
So Crimson Dawn, he used them to become the mob enforcer piece for Crimson Dawn. And then the Emperor steps in and takes the Emperor towards the end of Clone Wars. I don't remember if it was in Season 6, which went straight to DVD. And we may get more because Clone Wars is coming back to Disney Plus, their new streaming service. At the end of Clone Wars, the Emperor kicked Maul's butt and said, "You're going to be my tool." And I'm fairly certain that you could draw potential lines of thought that the Emperor decided to use the illegal underground element, the criminal element, as a shaping factor in the Outer Rim to keep them from rising up against the fledgling Empire. So I think that's what happened in the period between the end of the Clone Wars that we saw, Episode 3 and Solo, and then Rebels, in that order. And I believe that what we see in Solo is kind of Maul at his weakest, where he's not his weakest, but where the Crimson Sun or Crimson Dawn is under the thumb of the Emperor in a secret manner, and the Emperor is pulling Maul's strings to use the criminal element to destabilize the Outer Rim to keep them from becoming a threat to the fledgling Empire. And during that time, the Emperor takes what's left of Mandalore and shapes them into a force that we see in Rebels, where they are a police arm or an elite unit within the Empire. Any comment to that?
That's actually a pretty good point. I didn't think about, because now that you mention it, I do recall that awesome fight scene between Darth Sidious, Darth Maul, and what was his brother's name?
Savage Opress.
Savage Opress. That was an amazing scene in Clone Wars. But yeah, that does kind of make sense, the connection that you made there. And I do recall in Rebels how Sabine was very upset at was it Pre Vizsla, the one who was leading the aerial, I forget the name of the game, they were called Stormtroopers. But they were wearing kind of, it was a quasi stormtrooper / Mandalorian armor.
It was a white armor, like the original. They were Imperial Commandos, is what they were called.
Right. So yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call them a police force, because they pretty much guarded Mandalorian space, and they wanted to remain neutral as far as the involvement with the wanted to remain neutral as far as their involvement with the Empire. But there was that faction that, like you said, were the Imperial Commandos or whatever. I think it was led by Pre Vizsla, I believe so.
Well, I know he dies at some point because they bring that up in Rebels. But so I've been reading this book, and I'll talk about it during the quarter masterpiece, called Strategy Strikes Back. And they use Star Wars to explain tactics and military concepts. And there's an interesting thing called hybrid warfare. And hybrid warfare is a blend or tailored mix of ranging from conventional to irregular to terrorism and criminal behavior, where you use different elements to attack the populace. So like Russia, for example, is using not only cyber warfare against us, but they also use subterfuge in Crimea, where they dressed up and got...
I don't feel so hot.
So hybrid warfare, like I was saying, it's a blend of different ranges of warfare. And I think that the Emperor was doing his own version of hybrid war, where he was using the criminal element via Darth Maul and Crimson Dawn, and then he used irregular troops like the Mandalorians pressed into the Empire service, even though they weren't part of the Stormtrooper Corps, and then he had the Stormtrooper Corps as his massive oppressive force. But he used the criminal elements and the Mandalorians to destabilize the Outer Rim. Thoughts?
I think you nailed it, right? Because, and I'm going to kind of blend back a little bit into some of the legends, but if you've read the old books that kind of talk to where Palpatine came from and how he was trained as an apprentice, he learned all of these things. He learned how to manipulate situations and how to manipulate people and how to manipulate organizations. And that entire spectrum, right, from an individual all the way up through, you know, criminal syndicates to organized armies to irregular forces. I mean, he spent his entire life sculpting his ability to manipulate all of that to his end. And I think, you know, his entire life, his end was to bring the galaxy together in one empire. So I think you nailed it.
Yeah, in the book they were talking about how the rebels did their own hybrid warfare using smugglers and Ewoks in the Battle of Endor, but I think you could apply the same logic to the Empire at certain periods in its nascence as it grew up.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, all the way up to manipulating the Trade Federation, right? You talk about you go back to the prequels that shall not be named. you know, all of that was manipulation and staging. He even manipulated it in a lot of respects the Jedi, you know, as they were doing things like going out to Kamino, right, to look at the production of the clones, and I mean, all of that was all scripted and staged.
See, I don't even know if I'd call that. So that period was a pure manipulation period where he was pitting two armies against each other. I would say the hybrid war period. So by no means am I dismissing your very valid point about the architectural mind of Palpatine and how he orchestrated the whole Clone War. But I would say when you get into a hybrid war where you have a clear A versus B, where he didn't control the rebels or the dissident element in the Outer Rim. So I would say the hybrid war piece was more when he had a dissident force he didn't control. But definitely he was an architectural mastermind behind manipulating everybody into being distracted while he used that as a means to gain power and control of the Republic. Definitely agree with you there.
Well, yeah, but I think that's part of it. But you know, you talk about where's the line between being at war versus not at war, right? So at what point would you say he was at war? Was it when he executed the order and the Jedi started getting chopped down and he assumed complete control? Or was he at war way before that when he killed his master and started putting together his plan and manipulating things to his advantage? I mean, you know, you talk about hybrid warfare. Now, I didn't read the book that you're reading and that you're referencing, but this is just kind of my own take on it. Is you think about modern conflict and the history of kind of irregular warfare in our world, you know, you talk to an insurgent on the street, let's say in Central America, they consider themselves at war, whereas maybe the ruling power isn't. Right, they're just swatting down some nuisance criminals. So I think you're talking about, you know, where is that gray line of being at war versus not at war?
Yeah, I guess you could say in that regard, then the you know, the world of Star Wars pretty much had a period where there was no peace for, you know, from the moment the clone army was created and Darth Plagueis was struck down. Have you heard the tale of Darth Plagueis the Wise?
You ever hear the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise?
No.
I thought not. It's not a story the Jedi would tell you.
it's not a tale many Jedi would tell you. from that moment all the way to the fall of the Empire and even into the further policing actions of the early stages of the New Republic to the Battle of Jakku.
Right.
I think you're right. Eric, any further comments on the how the Mandalorians are being used as a manipulated tool?
No, I think you guys hit the nail on the head. In fact, in Rebels, again, I can't remember what season it was, but it was the season where Sabine is supposed to go back and kind of assume command of the Mandalorians, but they specifically talk about how the Empire is manipulating and using Mandalorians.
It was either three or four, and they kind of worked their way in there. But the she eventually hands over the Darksaber to Duchess Satine's sister, whose name also escapes me at the moment, and I believe... But I believe she was played or voiced by Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica. God, I'm having a horrible time with names tonight.
That is a true fact.
It's Katie Sackhoff.
Katie Sackhoff, yes. Katie Sackhoff. She did the voice of Satine's sister.
Who are you?
Kanan and Ezra, this is Lady Bo-Katan of House Kreese. Her sister, Satine, once ruled Mandalore. Bo-Katan was made regent by the Jedi before the end of the Clone War. She's still seen by many as Mandalore's rightful ruler.
So what happened?
After the Empire took over, I refused to obey the Emperor and was betrayed by the Saxon clan.
And it would be interesting to see if she pops up in the new Mandalorian series, live-action version, because she was fairly closely modeled after her.
I know that you don't participate in the Twitter sphere, but she's very active on Twitter, and there's a lot of people kind of campaigning for her to fill that role, actually.
Surprisingly enough,
I hear you say that, but the rumors floating around right now is that the Mandalorian is actually Sabine in her search for Ezra.
Interesting. So
at least that's the latest rumor that I've heard.
Do you guys want to talk about the Mandalorian TV show now, or do you want to wait till the end? I don't care. I mean, it's a good segue. Might as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll go back to the other topics later, but the Mandalorian, I'm excited for the show. They've been showing some props. It looks like, as you can see in the show notes, it looks like the gun that was used in the original introduction of Boba Fett is gonna be used in the show. The cast member from Game of Thrones who played the Viper, Pedro Pascal, has been cast as the lead. Whether that lead means he's the Mandalorian or some other character in the show, we don't know. Jon Favreau is directing. And then we've got Taiki Waititi, who did Thor Ragnarok and What We Do in the Shadows. You've got a couple other big TV and Netflix-type directors coming in. I believe one of the directors is from Jessica Jones. I mean, have you guys heard anything else about the show? I didn't know Katie Sackhoff had been petitioned on Twitter. I know her and Trisha Heffler are like best friends, and they're always going back and forth on Twitter. But other than that, I hadn't been following Twitter lately.
No, I think it's just it was just one of those things, like the fans rising up. They want to see her in it. You know, she's kind of typecast in all the sci-fi, so. I didn't see anything official by any means, but there was an announcement earlier today that Gina Carano from Deadpool was announced to be in the cast.
Which character in the first Deadpool? I'm drawing a blank.
Angel Dust.
It's not striking a chord. Oh, the muscle-bound female baddie. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, the big fight?
Yeah, no, I just heard the character name didn't connect.
Yeah, she's an MMA fighter.
Yeah, so she's the nudist. She was announced as cast?
Yeah, today.
Okay.
Today. I just saw the headline earlier today. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I think it's going to be an exciting series. I think it's going to be it'll be enough to get me to subscribe to Disney Plus. That, and they're going to do a Cassian series where they go back and do a kind of a prequel to Rogue One, where they follow Cassian and his Black Ops wet work type stuff, where he does some of that shadier Fulcrum rebel activity.
Yeah,
that was announced. Cool. That was announced this week too. But the show, I think, and one thing I think they're going to try and do is get away from bounty hunters. They may come into the show and they may use them as a tool to define what the Mandalorian is not. But I think they're going to, because you're supposed to be an Old West gunslinger type. I think he may end up being more like the sheriff is back in town and be against bounty hunters, because I think they want to put a separation between Boba Fett and the actual Mandalorian cast or clans. Thoughts?
I'm really just excited to see the Mandalorian, particularly coming to a live-action TV show. This is Lucasfilm, Star Wars' first live-action show. And the reason I like the TV show is because with that episodic type format, they can really truly build a character instead of rushing to kind of put a movie together in a two and a half, three hour format. They can really build the character and give more in-depth storylines and plots. So I'm just excited to see that aspect, especially with Mandalorians, because I've always liked the Mandalorian character.
So what do you think, I mean, given the time period, it's set like 3 or 4 years after the events of Return of the Jedi, and they are in the Outer Rim, away from the fledgling New Republic. So in that time period, you could see Sabine Wren, you could see Ahsoka, you could see maybe even Ezra, if they find him in the Outer Rim, wherever the frickin' space whales took him. What do you think? Who do you guys think may pop up in that time period? Do you think like Luke will show up in the background, or Han, or somebody?
I don't know if any of the mainline characters are going to pop up. They'll probably, if nothing else, be mentioned in the background. But something just kind of, I was thinking through when you were saying all of that, the timeline. You know, during that time after the Empire is defeated, there's going to be pockets still out there, right, away from the core, that are still going to fight, right? They're still going to think that the war's not over yet. They're still going to, you know, put up that resistance. So you think, I don't know if you've read any of the Aftermath books, Died in Versio.
I was just wondering if somebody was going to bring her up. I'm only familiar with her from Battlefront.
Right, and it's connected. It's all tied together. You know, the Battlefront, if you played through the solo campaign, which I'm sure you have, you've seen that storyline, it leads you right up to Aftermath. And you go back and you read the first one, it's the story before her character in Battlefront 2, where she's coming up, and her father sends her on these missions and whatnot. But I think that there's going to be some of that feel to the show. At least I hope there is, right? Because I thought that was a really cool way to kind of continue the storyline.
I loved her character. I would love to see Iden Versio. I mean, that time period should be a Rebel or New Republic. But I would love to see Iden Versio or her male counterpart, the two of them. I would love to see the two of them running around on the Outer Rim, chasing somebody, maybe hunting down some Imperial elements, like kind of like Nazis escaped to Argentina. The fragments of the Imperials escaped to the Outer Rim.
Yeah, and yeah, like there's those books. That's exactly what those books are all about, and highly recommend it if you haven't read them, but I think Chuck Wendig wrote them. There's two or three. I don't know, Eric, you might know better than me. It's been a minute since I read those, but
weren't there parts of Boba Fett's armor showed up in the book or something? Because somebody told me there was some and like Wendig had done some weird detached segments that were kind of hard to follow. He recently
this dude got a set of Mandalorian armor, and you know, they don't really come out straight up and say this is Boba Fett's armor, but you know, if he found it, some Jawans in Tatooine, and he basically took the armor and then killed all the Jawans, and then he was the new sheriff in town, kind of thing. So you know, I hope that a lot of that type of storytelling in that era it takes place in the show, because it was pretty cool. I mean, because they really were hunting down these. You know, there would be like a rogue Star Destroyer out there that was still, you know, brainwashed into thinking that the Emperor was still alive, you know, and they're holding out. They're going to fight the fight. And after the Emperor died, you know, he had kind of like a dead man switch that basically sent orders out to all these units elsewhere and to carry on the fight. So hopefully, you know, this show kind of picks up on some of that. I think that'd be really cool. You know, if it is, you know, Outer Rim, you know, lone gunslinger kind of stuff, I think that those types of stories would lend themselves really well to kind of keeping that continuity.
Well, knowing how heavily
picked.
Oh, go ahead, Eric.
I was saying, I think the time period they picked, because it's literally right after the fall of the Empire, is a prime time for what Jay just kind of described, because you're going to have, you know, so the Empire for all these years, they were the glue that kind of held everything together through oppression, yes, but they maintained order, and now that order is broken. You have, like you said, segments of the Empire who are still out there, still, you know, trying to follow the command, the last dying commands of Emperor Palpatine. You got the rebels who are trying to establish themselves as a new fledgling government. So they're still trying to, you know, assert their authority and show that why they should be in command, or why they should be allowed to govern. Excuse me. So yeah, this is an interesting time period, and there's going to be those pockets, particularly in the Outer Rim, because the Outer Rim has always been the afterthought. Even during the Old Republic era, they weren't really concerned. It's kind of like, you know, being out in the Wild Wild West. You know, they're just out there. Yeah, you pay your taxes and we, you know, you take your money, but we're not really concerned about you. They were kind of left to their own vices, and that's why all the gangsters, the slave traders, sex traders, all those people people kind of popped up in the Outer Rim because they weren't really governed. So this is a prime environment for somebody to come in and kind of, like you said, lay down the law. I'm going to be that one man kind of like equalizer type person.
Well, there's also a power vacuum because Jabba the Hutt was just killed too.
True.
So there will probably be rich ground. Now, I don't know if he was the Hutt. There are obviously a lot of Hutts, even in canon. In Clone Wars, you had they delved a little deeper into Nal Hutta and the Hutt regime. So yeah, I don't know.
There's going to be another Hutt to kind of fill his place. But I think he was the kingpin as far as the Hutt clan.
So there may be, we may get into the power vacuum argument there, or a new Hutt rising to power, or maybe even Jabba's son, who was touched on in the Clone Wars, jumping in there. I think they picked a good time. I think that and the pre-Rogue One era, I think I'm really interested to see what they do, and I think they made wise decisions in picking those two time frames. Any other comments on The Mandalorian?
Just excited to see the show. Can't wait for it to start.
Yep, totally stoked.
And I'm forward to it. I really do think Pablo Hidalgo, she's one of the... Is it Pablo Hidalgo, or am I getting that confused with somebody else?
So it's not Pablo Hidalgo. I keep confusing Pablo Hidalgo with Dave Filoni. I apologize profusely to Dave Filoni and Pablo Hidalgo for confusing the two of them. It's Dave Filoni.
Yeah, that's the name. I'm not sure if you're pronouncing it correctly.
Okay.
That's the guy.
Yeah, that's him.
Okay, his involvement will be, I think, instrumental, and he's one of the executive producers, so I'm sure he'll have heavy play, even though Favreau is overseeing the project. And Favreau is a huge fanboy, so I think that those two guys, being the huge fanboys that they are, will put down some impressive material that will maybe bring a little more peace to the collective of Star Wars fans that has been a little distorted in the recent years here with the Disney acquisition. I mean, I haven't been...
After the Last Jedi, I'm looking for a good show to kind of save Star Wars.
And maybe they'll find that medium of serialized entertainment much more palpable. I mean, Lucas grew up on serialized Flash Gordon episodes and the like. I think and Clone Wars did well in that nature too. Once they hit their stride and stopped doing things out of order. First season was all over the place. I'm really looking forward to it. So back to the other stuff we were going to discuss, the Mandalorians. I listed a couple of famous Mandalorians. I included some old legacy stuff with Mandalore and Candorous Ordo. We talked about Pre Vizsla already. We kind of brushed over. We did talk a little bit about Sabine Wren and how she went back in Rebels and tried to reunite the clans, even though they were under Imperial rule. Interestingly enough, somebody else pointed it out in another show I was listening to. We don't know what happened between the end of Rebels and A New Hope with the Mandalorians, because for all intents and purposes, it kind of sounds like the Empire got sick of them and went in and wiped them out, which they hinted at in Rebels that they were starting to try and do, because Pre Vizsla's brother, who was running Mandalore at the time under Imperial rule, had come up with something. And Eric, before we started talking on the episode, you had discussed the armor. Do you want to go discuss the armor for everybody and explain that piece to them? Because I think you were leading into that earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much Jay knows about the Mandalorian armor, but the reason why it was in such awe or in such
respected?
That's the word I'm looking for. Respected. That's not the word I was looking for, but good enough.
Renowned?
The reason
renowned?
Why I'm so respected is because the type of metal that it was resistant to blaster fire, it was resistant to lightsabers, and then it was only able to be, I think it was, what's the name of it? That was a Bastille? Beskar, that's what it was called. It can only be smith by Mandalorian metal workers. So they were the only ones who knew how to work with the steel. Otherwise, they couldn't melt it down. No other group of people were able to melt it down. down and work with the material. And like I said, it was the only metal that was truly resistant to blaster fire, lightsabers. The only thing that could really penetrate it was like at the joints. So the actual plates of the armor was pretty much impervious. That's one of the reasons why it was they grew this whole Mandalorian culture around the armor and why it was so important to them, because it was literally their shield, kind of like how talk the phalanx and the Spartans, kind of going back to that analogy you talked about earlier, the phalanx and how nothing could penetrate the phalanx. The same thing with the armor. Their armor was like their phalanx. It couldn't be penetrated unless you got them at the joint or something like that.
And I think in season 4 of Rebels, they talked about how the armor was like thousands of years old and just kept getting passed down from generation to generation as a family heirloom.
They were trying to hint that they don't have the metal workers to kind of forge new armor anymore, because in Legends, they obviously the Mandalorians could still work with the material or with the metal, but like you said, in Rebels, they kind of went away from that. The armor was passed down, and it was kind of reshaped to fit the body of the new owner, but they couldn't, like, almost seemed like they couldn't make new armor.
And it sounds like a nightmare at Sith, where you get issued somebody else's stinky plate carrier.
As long as it keeps you safe, right?
Yeah. Jay's laughing in the background. I can see him. You see him chuckling about nightmare days at Sif. That's consolidated.
Wearing his pajamas flying overhead.
Yeah, his flight suit didn't get handed down by somebody at Sif, but I'm sure he had plenty of Sif gear throughout his career. For the civilians.
Yeah, man. He gave us all the good stuff.
Yeah, well, because you flyboys just rate so much nice gear. Or is it just that the stuff over at the wing doesn't get used very often?
No, they issue your own flight gear. I mean, your helmet has to fit. You know, it gets fitted to your head over time with the heat and everything. There's a special kind of, like, gel pack or something in it that gets shaped. So it's not like you're getting some other dude's used helmet from prior use.
So you but guys don't
I
pass
still
down
your set of Sith gear, man. We still got issued all the regular crap.
For the civilians that are listening, Sith stands for Consolidated Issue Facility, which is basically like the issue point where they just throw all our garbage gear at us, and usually it's handed down and in ratty tat condition if you're down on the lower end. But apparently, if you swing with the wing, they get all the nice clean gear.
Our flight gear was new. Our Sith gear was the same Sith gear you got. I still had a Kevlar, a flak, and chicken plates, the whole nine yards.
So,
they suck.
So did your helmet, just out of curiosity, your flight helmet, was that something that once it was yours for life?
Because they can't reissue those. And in fact, I'll do you one better right here. Look,
you see that? Still have it?
Oh, can you see it?
Yeah. Is that yours from... Yeah, that's yours.
Yeah.
There's taxpayer dollars.
The helmet system.
Hey, it's nowhere near as expensive as the F-35 helmets.
No, it is not. It is not that sexy, no.
Well, those are millions and millions of dollars for those helmets, I hear. I can't...
Yeah, and I still got the old...
Nice. So was that something that you were expected to take with you from command to command and keep it in good condition?
My helmet?
Yeah.
Yeah, all the flight gear, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Never knew that.
The only crap we didn't have to, keep hold of was, we would wear float, I forgot what they were called, but the inflatable vests, that sort of thing, the flight vests, those were issued at the squadron level.
And your water wings?
The Marines took care of that stuff.
Your little water wings and your floaties?
Water wings, yeah. No, it was a little thing that was on your flight gear. A little tiny thing around your neck, and it inflates if you go in the water. That we wore over our flight suits, that stuff was issued at the squadron level.
Cool. So, I learned something new today.
Yeah, man. Steel toe boots, those were issued and kept. White flight suits, but everything else was pretty much the same as every other Devil Dog.
Good to go. So any other famous Mandalorians, or I mean, I Jay, I know you were at least I remember you being a fan of Boba Fett.
Yeah, favorite character. When I was a kid and I first saw Empire, that was it, man. I was like, oh, you know. I mean, as a kid, I didn't say that he's a badass, but I'm sure I thought whatever the child equivalent of that is.
He's so awesome!
Yeah, he's really cool. I want that suit, you know. He was always my favorite as a kid, and then, I mean, even today, you know, I'm still a huge Boba Fett fan. I've got you know, the old Legends books. I've got some comic covers that have Boba on them. I bought the issues just for the cover. I've got some action figures that I've kept for years and years and years. And I've even got a helmet, actual wearable helmet. In fact, I even have the Nerf, the special edition Nerf gun. That's Boba Fett's blaster, and it comes with a little protective face plate. That's a Boba Fett helmet.
You know, the psychology of Jay, your two favorite characters, to my knowledge, are Boba Fett and Iron Man.
Yeah.
You are a very armor-centric.
Yeah.
I wonder what that says about
this. You know what is really cool? I actually have a shirt that I bought. I think it was from Shirt Punch or one of those sites. That is an Iron Man dude, but his armor is in the style of Boba Fett.
I'm pretty sure I sent you the link to that shirt.
Yeah, you probably did, and that's when I bought it. Yeah, because I've had it for years and years.
So, yeah. I remember that, actually. Then there
was I thought about building a, and I worked on that Iron Man suit that I was 3D printing some of it and then crafting some of it by hand. But I thought about doing that suit in that style of Boba Fett because of how it looked.
That would have been a hit at any con.
Yeah, I never got around to finishing. I've got the helmet raw done, but it's not sanded and finished or any of that. And then a couple of the arms and hands and stuff somewhat worked on, but I just haven't had the time lately.
Good to go. Eric, any comments on your favorite Mandalorians or pseudo-Mandalorians?
I'm still kind of in awe that Jay has is building a helmet, and I'm really excited to see this fashion Boba Fett uniform. I agree. I really loved Boba Fett. He was a great character. I was sorely disappointed in the way that he supposedly died in Return of the Jedi. It's like, no, you can't do that.
By a blind man.
Like, right? You get taken out by accident. Come on, he's like the baddest bounty hunter in the galaxy. He's taken out by accident. Particularly, you know, back in Legends when all the books about Boba Fett and everything. I mean, he was, as you said, a true badass, and then he's taken out by, you know, a blind Han Solo. Come on now. And then, like you said, I think Jango Fett in Legends, Jango Fett was a Mandalorian. So the new, I guess, canon now is, and I'm not sure how they're doing that because I don't know if they're just disowning him because of his violent tendencies, or if he truly was an imposter. But in Legends, Jango Fett was the sole survivor of a massive Jedi Mandalorian conflict. He was known as, you know, one of the best Jedi killers because the Mandalorians and the Jedi were always at odds with one another. So he was very well respected within the Mandalorian community, and like he was one of my favorite Mandalorians was Jango Fett.
I mean, now here's the fun thing. Here's kind of why Disney went in and swept the plate clean. If it wasn't in the movies, Boba Fett had a bunch of back history that didn't mesh up with even the prequels, because originally he was wasn't he from Concord Dawn, and he went through a number of different background stories and names even. And then even at one point, you know, everybody in the old canon, he survived the Sarlacc. We don't know for sure if he did or didn't in the new canon. You know, even then, and then you had a couple of Fett imposters. The old canon got a little murky with Boba Fett's background.
Well, we know that in the new canon, his armor in the Aftermath books, at least they very heavily allude to it being his armor. I don't know if they outright say it.
And some people have said that Wendig's books may be the lead-in for the TV series, although Wendig just got fired, so he won't have any more influence there. All right, well, does anybody have any other comments about Mandalorians before we go into the Quartermaster segment? All right, so we didn't have any questions for Mail Call this week, so we'll go ahead and skip Mail Call and go ahead and submit your questions for the next episode. I'll take a shot on that because I didn't actually put it up until pretty late in the game on Facebook. But by any time, you can ask us questions and we'll get them up there.
Putananolia! Welcome to the Quartermaster. What do you want?
I'm going to talk about myself. I'll give Jay and Eric a minute to think about what they want to talk about from the Quartermaster. But for me, I've been reading this Strategy Strikes Back book. It was good reading on the airplane ride to California and back last week. It's written by Max Brooks and a bunch of other professors and military folks at West Point. They decided that they would be able to teach interestingly complex military strategic concepts through science fiction rather than try and go through the dry rote memorization methods. And it's called Strategy Strikes Back by Max Brooks, John Amble, M.L. Kavanaugh, and others. Some of it is stories written in the Star Wars universe. Some of it is people talking like historians and using Star Wars as a historical reference. And other sections are folks just flat out saying, hey, in Star Wars, they did this, which is similar to how in reality, you know, the contrawise or the similarity exists. They do kind of get stuck. A couple of the authors tend to get stuck on the military-civilian divide, which I think has gotten better in recent years, but at one point it was pretty bad, the military-civilian divide. A couple of folks, you can tell, really delve deep into the EU, the Expanded Universe pieces. Some people only understood the films, and some people kind of made some, I want to say, one or two people in here so far that I've read made some what I feel were inaccurate comparisons. But overall, I mean, they still got their point across. I won't go into the things. I think somebody, one person in here did mistake the religion of the Jedi for a governed military order. And while their points were valid, I think the analogy wasn't exactly 100% dead on for us super fanboys. But for a casual fan, it definitely made sense. So, Jay or Eric, do either of you guys have any military sci-fi stuff you played or read or watched in the past couple weeks?
Unfortunately, I did not come prepared for that aspect of it. But I think that's pretty cool. I'm glad to pick up what you just talked about.
Well, I told one of your fellow cube mates over there that I was going to lend him the book, but you can have it after him.
Sounds like a plan. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, no problem.
Yeah. Thanks for that book recommendation. I'm definitely gonna pick that one up and check it out. Also, earlier on, I showed a book that I picked up actually at Barnes & Noble in the clearance bin. I think it was $2. It's the Psychology of Star Wars, and it's a collection of essays, basically, written by various folks, psychologists primarily, that delve into different aspects of psychology through the lens of Star Wars. So some of it's analyzing things that happen, some of it's analyzing characters, some of them are around like societal issues and drawing a comparison between those issues in today's world with how they're addressed in the Star Wars universe. So similar to what you're talking about, but not purely military bent to it. There's a series of those books, actually. I also have the one that's a Psychology of Star Trek, and one also that's Walking Dead. So a lot of real interesting psychological insights drawn through those. I've read most of the Walking Dead book and the Star Trek book, but I just picked up Star Wars, so that's in the queue. So I think that's definitely worth a mention.
No, that's good, and I do find an interesting shift. If you go back to when we were kids, a lot of people were dismissive of pop culture as a teaching tool. Overall, I mean, some people did. Oh, that's beautiful. He's showing me this Boba Fett. What is that?
That is the special edition Nerf Rivals set.
Oh.
So you can see the protective faceplate there. It comes with a patch, an embroidered patch.
We'll have I'll have to find, you know what, if you could take a picture of that, we can link that or post that on the Facebook page.
Yeah, I'll get a picture with some better lighting, but that's the inside of the box. I kept the box because it's
pretty, dude. That is a thing of art.
Yeah.
So as I was saying, though, I do find it interesting that a lot of folks in the 80s were dismissive of pop culture as just trite entertainment, and now people are using it as a teaching tool to get through where, you know, some of the classics might not be as well received these days by folks. There are still lessons to be learned, even in pop culture phenomenons like Walking Dead and Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars and Star Trek.
Absolutely.
All right, well, that's all I have for this episode. Any closing comments from anybody? Nope.
I was just happy to join the call for the first time and looking forward to the next discussion.
Now, thanks again, man. I had a good time, as always. Looking forward to the next one. Any idea what we're going to be talking about next?
I think maybe we could talk about how science fiction has influenced military technology. I think that's ripe for discussion. We can talk about cell phones, active cloaking technology, or active camouflage, drones.
BFTs.
All I gotta say is Star Trek. Everything from Star Trek is now a reality.
Yeah.
Phasers and warp drives.
So
everything except for the phasers and warp drives. So wait on that.
Yeah.
So what we could do, man, is post up some a call for ideas. You know, folks want to write in and kind of throw one or two sentences out of you know, their ideas on that, and we can tee that up for discussion too.
Yeah, sounds good. I've only got a couple of notes, but I mean, there's a lot of stuff in science fiction that is, and I think I touched the one news episode we talked about power armor and some things like that, but I really do think that military science fiction has heavily influenced the evolution of military technology in the last 20 or 30 years. All right, out here. Let's make this quick, because I'm really booked. I'm a devious, degenerate defender of the devil. Shut down all the trash compactors on the detention level. My backpacks got chests. Well, I'm Boba, the Fett. Well, I bounty hunt for Jabba Hutt to finance my vet. Well, I chill in.
Today's episode was brought to you by the following sponsor.
Putananolia! Welcome to Watto's Junkyard. We got all the scraps and the ships you need. Engines for that brand new Z95 Headhunter. A Corellian Engineering Flux Bypass. Haha! Need a hyperdrive for that Nubian? Well, sorry, fresh out of that one. Steel! Come down to Watto's Junkyard. We've got all the parts you need at the prices you can't afford to ignore. And remember, Republic credits are no good here. Do not try Jedi mind tricks on me. They don't work. I'm a Tidarian.
It's over, Anakin. I have the high ground.
This is it, baby.
Hold me.
Legal disclaimer. We are just a bunch of a-holes that get together and discuss the things we love. We have no official affiliation with or in any way represent the DoD or any of the branches of uniformed service. Any intellectual property in audio clips or discussion is used for the purposes of review or parody and are all copyright the specific IP holders, all of whom are listed on our Reddit page or often in the show notes. Any issues can be addressed to our email via prpg.podcast@gmail.com. Background audio by Dragon Musician, entitled Moonlit Beach. Carry on, you filthy animals.